Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. In Genesis, Yahweh punishes Adam and Eve for desiring knowledge. To Adam, he gives a lifetime of back-breaking work. To Eve, he says, "I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you will bring forth children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." Ancient Judaism expressed pain in childbirth and patriarchy as one conjoined double whammy from God. But it wasn't until the 19th century, with the invention of male-dominated obstetrics, that the patriarchs took over childbirth completely. With obstetrics came many alleged improvements in the natural process of childbirth, starting with forceps, which have continued making childbirth more difficult and dangerous up to this day. OBs cut women's vaginas to help the baby out when all the literature says this is an unnecessary and harmful practice. We strap birthing women onto beds with faulty birthing monitors instead of encouraging them to walk and squat, and then give them C-sections when their labors don't progress. And yet, through both public policy and medical technology, we have reduced maternal and infant mortality, made the barren fertile, given parents choices about when to have children and the kind of children they can have. Although technologies such as electronic fetal monitoring do more harm than good today, once they are cheap, portable, and effective, what pregnant woman would forgo 24-hour assurance that her baby is doing okay? On the horizon, with genetic control, in vitro fertilization, and perhaps artificial wombs, we may yet free women from the burden of childbirth altogether. My guest today, Robbie Davis Floyd, is the leading anthropological observer of this technologizing of childbirth. Her books, Birth as an American Rite of Passage, and most recently, Cyborg Babies, an edited volume, firmly situates the customs and practices around childbirth within gendered power relations, the power of professionals, and within a techno-capitalist culture attempting to control and commodify everything that was formerly natural. Most recently, her essays and edited volume, Cyborg Babies, plunge into the technologizing of childbirth from the perspective of the growing branch of cultural criticism known as cyborgology. From her base at the Department of Anthropology at the University of Texas, Austin, she's currently studying midwifery in the U.S. and Mexico. Dr. Davis Floyd, how'd you get interested in the study of childbirth?
Well, the same way many people do. I got pregnant and I had my first child, and my birth experience was a very confusing one. And I ended up with a 26-hour labor and then a cesarean section, and it was a planned hospital birth, but I had planned to have it in the birth center with the pretty Halston sheets and the rocking chair and all of that, and it didn't work out. I got kicked out into labor and delivery because my labor went on too long, and I got put on Pitocin for augmentation, and then I ended up with what later I came to understand was an unnecessary cesarean. So that left me with a lot of questions about why that happened to me after all my childbirth education classes and all my preparation and all my desire for natural childbirth. Did I really need a cesarean? Didn't I? Why did my friend, who had a 36-hour labor that started at the same time as mine with a different kind of obstetrician, why did she end up having a lovely natural childbirth in the hospital when I wasn't able to? Was it my body? Was it the technology? What was the problem? So I started asking questions. I asked other women about their birth experiences, and then I began to read, and I read everything I could get my hands on. And over time, I decided that it wasn't just about me. It was about American women and American society in general, and that I should do my dissertation on the topic. So that's how I got started.
Mm-hmm. So your dissertation involved interviews with women about their childbirth experiences.
Yes. Eventually, for the book, I interviewed 100 women about their birth experiences.
And the theme that you've explored in that work has been about the technologizing of childbirth. You, as you say, you were very unhappy with the kind of childbirth that you had originally. You went on to have a home birth, is that right?
I did. I went on to have a vaginal birth after cesarean at home, which is still considered somewhat of an aberrant choice, since there's all this literature showing the risk of uterine rupture with VBACs. But for me, it was a very deeply felt choice and one that was life-transforming, as women who make the choice to have a VBAC at home usually are very, very committed to that choice. We understand the risks, and we find midwives who support us, and we feel we have a better chance of succeeding. But it's not a culturally normative choice, and it was important for me to make it. That was part of my process of growth, part of my personal process of development. It meant a great deal to me.
You've become very involved with midwifery organizations and natural childbirth organizations.
I am. I've always had this curious tension within myself between my roles as an activist and an anthropologist. I used to really agonize about that. And then I realized anthropology had said, and during the time I was struggling with that, anthropology moved into its postmodern phase where anthropologists acknowledge that we always influence what we study, so we might as well try to influence for good in a conscious way. So then it wasn't so difficult for me to reconcile those roles anymore. They kind of flowed into one. My anthropology informs my activism and vice versa.
Now, the theme of this dichotomy of natural childbirth versus technological childbirth, it's kind of ironic because the first inventors of anesthesia and a lot of original obstetrics was actually motivated to try to help women to relieve their suffering in childbirth, and a lot of early feminists were excited about some of these inventions. And then the 60s wave of feminist criticism of obstetrics came along and the midwifery and natural childbirth, and they said, no, all that's actually oppressive and patriarchal. Isn't there a problem with this 180-degree flop?
There is. It's the way Ginsburg childbirth has turned out with its heavy use of anesthesias and later analgesias like epidurals has been very much a co-creation of women and obstetricians. It was women who went over to Germany in the 1920s and brought back scopolamine, twilight sleep, which was the anesthetic of choice in childbirth for decades after that. And, of course, women eagerly embraced the epidural when it became available because it offered a conscious birth. You could be awake and aware, but you didn't have to feel any pains. And for women, the consciousness obliteration of scopolamine was far less preferable to the consciousness permission that the consciousness, the possibility for consciousness that the epidural gave. But it has been a joint enterprise between women and obstetricians, and that was something that the first sort of feminist wave of criticism of childbirth that began in the late 60s and went on through the 70s kind of missed the point that many American women were asking for anesthesia and or analgesia and wanted pain relief during childbirth. And I think those of us who came after that, I started writing in the 1980s, we've been much more aware that that most American women make choices for technology and pain relief in childbirth, and those who want what we refer to as natural childbirth with full awareness that there's really no such thing as natural in this highly cultural world. But anyway, most women who want natural childbirth are the minority in American society. So it's important to understand that the obstetrical system exists as a co-creation of women and physicians, and that those who really want alternatives are just that. They're alternative. They're more marginal. There are fewer of them. But it's important for them, for me, that what matters is keeping open the spectrum of choice so that people can make choices along the full range of options.
A lot of, the feminist criticism of childbirth, like a lot of radical criticism in general, argues from a position that people who want things that we don't think they should want have a false consciousness. And so you're not saying that. My wife, by the way, is very exercised today about this woman who killed her 5 kids in Texas because of the apparent Christian domination of her culture, that she would have 5 kids under the age of 7 without sufficient spacing, without sufficient support. So there's false consciousness on the side of those who are for natural alternatives. A lot of home birthers are also homeschoolers, are also Christian fundamentalists. So there's false consciousness on all sides, isn't there?
Well, I just hate to accuse anyone of false consciousness. People come from within their belief systems and they make choices according to those belief systems. People who choose to give birth at home, for example, span this very wide spectrum of religious belief. There's a wonderful new book that's about to come out by Pamela Klassen called Blessed Events, Religion and Childbirth in America. And she interviews home birthers who have this amazingly eclectic potpourri of religious beliefs. Some home birthers, as you say, are devout Christian fundamentalists. Others are Orthodox Jews. Others are non-Orthodox Jews. Others are New Age people. Some are goddess worshippers, you know. They completely span the spectrum, and accusing anyone of false consciousness, for me, it's just not a place that I like to come from theoretically. I'd rather try to understand that individual's motivations in terms of their own worldview and their own life experience rather than saying that one belief system or way of doing things is right as opposed to another.
Another thing that's in the news this week is that the French are in a real tizzy because a 62-year-old French woman gave birth to a child that was had a donor egg from another woman and her brother's sperm, and the child's twin was born by the egg donor in California, and then all the kids are living together in France now with the brother and sister. So you read about this case.
I haven't, actually.
Oh, yeah.
We'll have more and more of that as life goes on.
Exactly. And it kind of brings us to your cyborgology that Donna Haraway wrote an essay back 20 years ago about the breaking down of the nature-technology dichotomy and ways that women can empower themselves by embracing technology. Isn't this another, again, to keep exploring this problem, feminist critique of reproductive technology generally has been hostile to it as a part of patriarchal control, but many women embrace these technologies as ways of expanding their control over their own lives.
Exactly. That's why I was happy to find Donna Haraway's essay, Cyborg Manifesto, years ago, and to begin to work with her notion of the cyborg, because I needed a way out of the oppositions that were kind of confining me, the notion that technology is either all bad or all good, the notion, even in my own book I talk about, in Birth is an American Rite of Passage, I talk about two paradigms of healthcare, the technocratic model, which is very mechanistic and defines the body as a machine and alienates patient from practitioner and treats the patient as an object, and the holistic model, which is very unified and organic and energy-oriented. The body is an energy field, not a machine, that sort of thing. And there's a lot of connection and communication and oneness between patient and practitioner. But life is really a spectrum, and it's more fluid than that. And to be in the place of technology is all bad precludes the possibility that technology is sometimes actually very, very helpful and good. As any infertile woman who's gotten pregnant with IVF will tell you, technology is an incredible thing sometimes. On the other hand, women who enter that IVF cycle and spend years of their lives and thousands of dollars with round after round of attempts with a 10% success rate, which some clinics still are running a 10% success rate, although others are doing better, especially if women are younger. You know, once you get on that treadmill, you can throw away a huge chunk of your life hoping that the technology will fulfill its promise. So what's wonderful about the notion of a cyborg is that it encompasses all those ambiguities. Cyborgs, as Haraway says, are full of the promise of miracles and the promise of monsters all at the same time. So it gives you a way of looking at technology that encodes the upside and the downside, the miracles and the monsters.
I'm speaking today with Robbie Davis Floyd, who's an anthropologist who studies childbirth. In your article in the Cyborg Babies book, From Technobirth to Cyborg Babies, you talk about the ambivalence vis-a-vis your own experience, that if you had had this vision, this perspective of cyborgology when you had your first child, that you might have had a totally different perception. You might not have been so alienated by the process of your first childbirth experience.
Well, I was being a little bit sarcastic in that essay when I talk about how when I'm lying there numb from my shoulders to my toes, during that cesarean, I felt completely disembodied. I lived in my head. I understood Cartesian mind-body separation. I existed only as a head during the surgery. And I was a little sarcastic when I said if I'd only known about the cyborg, maybe it would have been a more positive experience. But there was that part of me that wondered when I was, you know, lying in that condition, completely detached, unable to even move my arms, couldn't feel anything below my neck, if I had known about cyborgs, would I have stopped to think, well, okay, I'm obviously a cyborg now. And, you know, I mean, the thing is that if the procedure had been life-saving, if I had been one of those cesareans that was really necessary to save my life and or the baby's life, then I could have been grateful and I could have seen in that cesarean the miracle and not the monster part of the cyborg. But it was an unnecessary cesarean, which I suspected at the time, which I confirmed later, and so it was very difficult for me to be appreciative. But at the same time, the cyborg does encompass those cesareans, which are miracles, which are life-saving. And sometimes to be a cyborg in childbirth is absolutely the best thing and miraculous for mother and child. The problem is the over-application and the over-utilization of those technologies. If they were confined to their proper place and to the truly life-saving times when technologies like cesareans are needed, that would be fantastic. That would be a miracle. It's just that they're massively overused. That's the problem.
No, there has been a rise in the last couple of years of elective cesarean sections, women who go in saying, you know, I'll just skip that whole part, and you can just take it out anytime you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that that's self-control, or is that part of the, I mean, you don't want to use the word false consciousness, but do you think that that's a wrong choice, a bad choice?
Well, again, I don't want to use the word false consciousness. I interviewed a group of women after I wrote my first book. I did an article called The Technocratic Body, American Childbirth as Cultural Expression. And for that article, I interviewed 40 women about their self and body images in relation to pregnancy and birth. And most of them were professional women in positions of power in their corporations. Maybe they were CEOs. And about 35 of them had this major mind-body dissociation. They would say, my body is a vehicle, a tool that carries me around. It's a tool that I use to succeed in the world. And for them, pregnancy and childbirth were not these amazing natural processes unfolding in their bodies. They were just sort of what you had to go through to have a baby. Some of them said, I don't like being dragged down into biology in order to be pregnant. I'd rather be an intellectual and emotional woman and not a biological one. Some of them said if my husband could have the baby instead of me, that would be great. And several of them wanted to schedule their cesareans sort of between conference calls, as it were, because they just didn't really want to take time. The event of birth was not important to them. That is not a notion shared by all women or even the majority of women, but there are some women who really are very frightened of the natural process of labor. And they, for them, scheduling a cesarean is a way of taking control of an event that otherwise they would feel would be random, chaotic, out of control, unpredictable, and dangerous. And they feel safer with an elective cesarean, even though it carries a risk of infection and maternal mortality. It's not a very high risk. It's a real risk, but it's not terribly high. So women often feel safer running that risk than running the risk of what they perceive as the risks of natural labor. It's important to understand that there's a spectrum of possibility in childbirth that extends at one end. Scheduling cesareans is like the extreme end of taking technological control of birth. And the other end of that spectrum, where you have the most untrammeled, most completely free natural birth, are when women have unassisted births at home, which is a very small minority of women, but there are some women that do that. And that women make choices along the entire range of that spectrum. And I think women should have the right to make choices along the entire range of that spectrum. I don't support, particularly myself personally, the choices at either extreme. I think scheduled cesarean is an extreme choice, and I think unassisted childbirth at home is an extreme choice. But I wouldn't want to deny a woman's right to make those choices.
Because really, the other extreme, the natural extreme, includes folks who reject medicine altogether, including the beneficial things that can be done, folks who believe in spiritual healing and so forth.
Yes. Well, the women who give birth unassisted tend to have deep intuitive knowledge of their body and a deep spiritual sense about the birth process, and they usually have what I call amazing birthing stories. Their births are truly astonishing, usually highly spiritual experiences, and I would not want to take away their right to have those experiences and to make that choice. Usually it comes out of this deep intuitive connection, so they're relying on information that their own bodies and their spirits, and in some cases they think God provides the necessary information. But as an advocate, I certainly am in support of planned midwife-attended home births. But I don't actively support an assisted childbirth, but I do support a woman's right to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've written that your observation of midwives who are fully prepared to use many of these technologies, who come with a whole van of technology to their births, that they may be the models for a kind of organic cyborgology of childbirth as opposed to this oppressive hospital-based cyborgification of childbirth.
Yes, can you say exactly. Midwives use technologies in extremely appropriate ways, and the technologies they use are very sophisticated. The knowledge that they have of those technologies and how to apply them is a very sophisticated knowledge, but they're very unobtrusive in the use of those technologies. They don't use them to dominate and manipulate and manage birth. They use technology to facilitate a woman's ability to give birth. So, for example, during a home birth, maybe the woman gets exhausted, it's been a long labor, she's pushing and she runs out of energy, a midwife may offer oxygen to help give her more energy as she pushes. A midwife is certainly going to be monitoring the fetal heart tone, so she'll know whether or not the baby is in any danger and whether or not transport is indicated. So home birth midwives have, out of every 100 women who start out to have a planned home birth with a midwife, about 92 of them will successfully give birth at home. They have about a 92% success rate, and they'll need to transport about 8% of their clients. And of those, and of the 100 women, two of those who were transported will be in emergency transports. Most of the other six will be transports for preventative reasons, or maybe after birth for something, possibly a retained placenta, and then two will be emergencies. So the spectrum of possibility in home birth, it's a very safe choice. Midwives use technologies wisely and well in most cases.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, my wife and I had both of our kids at home, and we lived about a block and a half from the University of Chicago's hospital's emergency room, and I worked at the University of Chicago. And when my colleagues, some of whom worked in the neonatal intensive care unit, found out that we were doing that, they were ready to call DCFS and have us pulled in. They were horrified. But we looked at the same statistics that you have, that home birth is extremely safe and in some ways safer than a hospital birth.
Yes. The reason home birth is sometimes safer than hospital birth is not about mortality. Out of every 1,000 babies, one or two are going to die no matter where you are, no matter what setting you're in, congenital abnormalities and that sort of thing. But so the perinatal mortality rates for low-risk women giving birth at home are the same as those for low-risk women giving birth in the hospital. But what's different in the hospital is that there's so many more interventions in birth that you get high rates of damage, what they call iatrogenic or doctor-induced damage to mothers and babies, from over-application of forceps or vacuum extraction or overuse of cesarean or overuse of episiotomies. Those kinds of technologies can cause harm, whereas home birth midwives don't tend not to do that sort of thing.
So let's follow that line for a second. If we were able to take a lot of these technologies to the home and have them be applied by judicious, non-interventionist lay midwives or trained nurse midwives.
A caveat there, the lay midwives have professionalized and they call themselves direct entry midwives now, meaning that they enter into midwifery directly without passing through nursing. It's just a more professional term. They don't like being called lay. It's an image they've been trying to leave in the past.
Mm-hmm. You've recently written an article about direct entry midwives.
Yes.
Let's follow that. If we took trained midwives with a bunch of technology and we were able to have effective electronic fetal monitoring and so forth, would that be the kind of ideal merger of technology if women who could deliver in the home were able to deliver in the home? Would there be any problem there? I mean, isn't that the merger of technology, of techné and nature that we're looking for?
No. No, electronic fetal monitors alter the experience of birth as they're monitoring the baby's heart tones and the strength of contractions. They're requiring that the mother stay put, that the mother be in bed tethered to the monitor, as it were, with the two monitor belts around her belly. And that, having to stay put, completely alters the experience of birth. Home birth is pretty much a flow. Sometimes you're up walking around, sometimes you're eating, sometimes you're dancing, sometimes you're outside taking a walk, sometimes you're in the hot tub or the jacuzzi. You move, and that's part of what makes home birth work so well, is that it's really important for women to move during labor. Movement increases blood and oxygen supply to the baby and helps the contractions be more effective and helps labor progress. So just a simple act of attaching a woman to a monitor continuously during labor means that she has to stay in bed, and that in itself shifts the whole dynamic of labor. So no, it would not be a good idea to take the monitor home, besides which there are a number of randomized controlled trials which have shown that trained professionals like midwives, nurses, or physicians auscultating, in other words, listening to heart tones with either the fetoscope or the Doppler, have just as good or better results as the fetal monitor in detecting distress. And the monitor use leads to higher cesarean rates, but auscultating manually does not.
Mm-hmm.
So for all those reasons, if you bringing the monitor home would be like putting the hospital in the home. That doesn't work ideologically or physiologically either way.
Hmm. Now, you've also recently branched out from birth. You read an article about the commercialization of space based on stories that you collected of men involved in the Strategic Avionics Technology Working Group. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
I met the director of that group, the administrator, who his name is Ken Cox, and I met him at a conference, and he told me that he was planning a meeting in Washington, and the theme was going to be a vision for commercializing outer space. And I got intrigued, and so I attended that meeting. I got my department to send me, because we were working on a book called Corporate Futures at the time, and I thought I might write a chapter for that book. I did eventually write a chapter about it for a different book, and I was fascinated. Here was a group of aerospace engineers. For me, what was intriguing was the the oxymoron in a vision for commercializing outer space. My immediate image was giant McDonald's orbiting the planet. And I thought, you know, what do they mean? What's visionary about commercializing outer space? Well, it turned out it was about building launch vehicles. You know, the more rockets you can build, the more communication satellites you can launch, the more you can ring the Earth with satellites, the more and the satellites suck information up from the planet, beam it around to each other, and beam it back down at the planet. So what, for me, it's as above, so below. You know, as we massively technologize reproduction and childbirth, we're also massively technologizing all of cultural life. And here we're aerospace engineers literally talking about cyborgifying the entire planet, turning the entire planet into a techno-organic system.
Mm-hmm. Which you are opposed to.
Well, no, that's the thing about technology. Would you want to do without those satellites? Would you want, you know, you couldn't use your ATM machine, you couldn't fill your gas pump, you couldn't use your credit card at the gas pump, you couldn't use your cell phone. We've all become entirely dependent on those technologies.
Mm-hmm.
It's, but we don't know we really don't understand the consequences of poking holes in the ozone every time you launch a rocket. What are the environmental consequences of that? One of the arguments NASA makes in support of those kinds of programs and in support of the International Space Station is that the technologies that are developed in outer space benefit us back here on Earth, and certainly they do. That's from Velcro to cell phones. Outer space technologies have massively benefited us on Earth. We just don't understand. I want us to take the overview and ask, you know, what is the how many objects can you put in Earth orbit? Before the radio waves and microwaves and communication waves flying around have some kind of environmental effect that we may not even have bothered to look for yet. If there's a thing that I call the 1-2 punch, you know, the 1-2 punch of life in the technocracy, it comes from an anthropologist called Peter Reynolds. And that is that if you alter a natural process with technology, there are consequences of that, which then usually require the use of more technology to fix the problems that you created the first time. And that's what we were doing, right? We're in this escalating 1-2 punch that's leading to global warming and thinning ozone layers and all the rest of it. And I think we just need to ask ourselves questions and to be very careful. I don't know if you saw the Bill Moyers show Earth on Edge the other
mm-hmm.
night.
Did, yeah.
Well, a lot of experts are giving it 30 years. You know, in the next 3 decades, we better make some really well-informed, really intentional choices about our future. That future will be a cyborgian one. But to what degree can we afford environmentally to cyborgify, and how can we cyborg, given that we're going to become cyborgs, there's really no stopping that process, how can we do it in a sustainable, environmentally conscious way that allows women and everyone to make choices for ecology and organicity as much as for technology?
We only have a minute left, but can you tell us something about the book that you're writing on ritual?
Yes. It's about the role of ritual in everyday life. It's called The Power of Ritual, and it's really kind of an anatomy of ritual, what ritual is, what makes it work in the cultural world, why ritual makes a difference in people's consciousnesses, how is ritual, what is it that makes ritual transformative?
Mm-hmm. Great. I've been speaking with Robbie Davis Floyd. She's an anthropologist at the University of Texas at Austin and probably the leading anthropological observer on the topic of childbirth. You can find her publications online at her very beautiful website, which I guess you designed yourself?
No, Ed Goldberg in New York City designed it for me, which I very much appreciate, and my current webmaster is Donna Kidwell in Austin, Texas.
It's very beautiful. It's at www.davis-floyd.com. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.